This is a podcast from policyreview.tv.
Good morning, everybody. I had the privilege to be asked to write a review of the funding of children and adults' end-of-life care. I know very little about children, apart from having them, and sadly, my eldest child having died, so I've sort of learnt a little bit on the ground about that. But it was fascinating looking at children and adults together. And the thing that it taught us, first and foremost, Alan Craft and I, was a very important lesson, which is that end-of-life care is not about age, and nor is it about disease. It's all about needs. And that, I think, was one of the most important conclusions we came to in our review, was that whatever recommendations we made should be based on promoting the support of the needs of the individual patient and family. And actually, the moment you start slivering it by disease or age, you lose an opportunity that is sitting there. And to take the point that was made earlier about dementia, one in four cancer patients who Marie Curie is currently looking after has dementia as well. And for those of you who saw the splendid picture in The Guardian this morning of the 100-year-old Sikh from Britain completing the marathon, lots more of us are going to be running eight-hour marathons at the age of 100, including you, Mike. And but those of us who don't quite get there are likely to die in a much more complex way with several diseases. So my first recommendation from the review with Alan was let's try and put this disease thing to bed and really concentrate on assessing the patient need. So what did this review say? I'm going to divide this talk into two parts. First, we get my watch. The first thing I want to talk about is, because I'm asked to say, how can the review improve end-of-life care for patients and families? And I think the review won't on its own, so I just wanted to touch on a couple of things that I think we've all got to be conscious of. And just to paint the scene very quickly, yes, let's be cup half full. I'm permanently full and overflowing with optimism. But there is some cause for concern. Two things. I was in a very large city last week for 2 days. It's one of the three largest cities in Britain, and it's not London. I was desperately trying to find out, and for those of you who know Marie Curie a bit better, you'll be able to work out where it is very quickly. We're building a brand new hospice in this city, and as you can imagine, as I'm taking delivery of the keys of that hospice in 362 days, I'm quite interested to know whether anyone's going to commission it. And you should know that at the end of those 2 days, despite speaking at every level in the city, I was unable to identify who will be commissioning that hospice for the next 2 years. So there is first of all, I think, you know, we've just got to accept that there's a serious worry out there about how end-of-life care services that simply don't fit into a commissioning cluster of some 150,000 people, say, because this very large city is finding its GPs aren't terribly used to collaborating with each other, and are perhaps struggling a little bit to agree that end-of-life care could be provided in a similar way in this cluster to the next-door cluster. But no, it's got to be different. So I think we've got to understand that that's going to be a problem. Anyone from East Sussex here? East Sussex also has its challenges. I was in East Sussex last week talking to all the East Sussex hospices at their AGM. And you have a population of about 250,000 people with four GP clusters. Now, how are they going to commission end-of-life care across really a very small population like that, effectively, with four different clusters? So there's some things we've just got to grasp, but my recommendation to you is to stay incredibly focused and just hope that our review will be accepted, firstly, by the government, and secondly, will then be implemented by others, because, of course, it's very difficult for the government to dictate these days. So that's an issue. So what were the core recommendations? Well, the first recommendation was that Mike has written a fantastic strategy and we shouldn't change it. So we don't seek to do that. Secondly, Mike has already highlighted this rapidly changing population and this demographic that commissioners are beginning to understand now, that just to stand still in terms of numbers of hospital deaths, just to stand still rather than increase, they've got to get a lot of people out into the community over the next 3 to 4 years. So I do hope strongly that this 24/7 community service issue is going to be addressed. We do, in our review, reflect on the evidence we took, and we went all over England. I recognise many faces from those who gave evidence to the review. And three things, came up most in that evidence. The first has already been mentioned, which is lack of 24/7 services. And bluntly, if you haven't got 24/7 services, I would argue that it's impossible to provide good end-of-life care. And I think it's quite a good place to start that. Secondly, some really shocking evidence around assessment of need. I will never forget taking evidence in Quidnam Hospice in Norfolk, one of the most wonderful places I've ever visited. It's an old farmhouse. It's just wonderful, part of East Anglian Children's Hospices. And I took evidence from a group of families. And it was quite difficult to take evidence because there were a lot of very small and very sick children running around. And, of course, they not only grabbed the attention but the emotion. And one of them insisted on holding my hand all the way through taking this evidence, which made it more compelling. But not one of the mothers I talked to had ever been sat down, either by social care or by the NHS, and had their needs assessed. And I found that absolutely stunning. So no one had said to them, what do you need for your child? There have been lots and lots of professionals. Strangely, by the way, the average number of professionals involved in an adult journey is 32, and it also is in a children's journey. So it's another example of why adults and children are so similar, rather than where I think we were before Alan and I started this review. It is, why on earth has the Secretary of State asked Tom to look at these two together? And I learnt a lot from those children on behalf of adults, because I thought even if really sick children can't command the attention of someone to assess their needs, what chance does a demented, single, hard-to-reach adult in Hackney have of having their needs assessed? So it was a really dramatic piece of evidence for me, and we saw that everywhere. And also the total inequity, too. We took evidence again, actually, in the same patch, where one family were able to get a wheelchair very easily for their child, who was dying, and another mother had to stand, I have her permission to tell you this, had to stand on the village green with a collecting tin and beg for her family to get a wheelchair to look after their child. So, as I said when I launched the review, not exactly what you'd expect in Western Europe in 2011. So great disparity. So the funding system that we recommended had to be based on patient need rather than age or disease. The second point that arose was the sheer complexity of managing your own care. And remember, my instruction from the Secretary of State was to look very much at a person-centric funding system. And the phrase that came through again and again and again is, why don't I have a case manager? As we went, I think it's my braces buttons which have come off, which I'm not wearing my braces today, but I'm doing this with my microphone. As we went round taking this evidence, again I got more and more struck by the bleeding obvious, which is, why don't we provide dying people with a case manager? Or even a system that would allow them to have their case managed. So Marie Curie, well, there's a wonderful coordination centre now in Lincolnshire, which St Barnabas are operating, and it's making a real difference to patient care. And we've just won a very large contract across a large patch, which hasn't been announced yet, to do exactly the same, which is to provide a centre where patients can go to, a single point of access. And I know that somewhere in the southeast, because the person who's doing it in this audience is trying to do the same at the moment, bring lots of agencies together. So coordination was the other area that Alan and I felt had to be provided. And that one of the ones, and they'll be all different, they probably won't be disease specific, and I think end-of-life care will go. So I'm very, very worried about that. So I think we may all, in the voluntary sector in particular, have to become a little bit more vocal again than we've been for the last 2 or 3 years. Good luck, Mike. just mention that in passing. So what does this mean? Well, it means that for end-of-life care, we should know what our statutory entitlement is. And we should also know what the voluntary sector will provide to us if we ask for it, but which the state won't fund. So as we know, historically, it's been higgledy-piggledy. It's been very unclear as to what the state should fund and what the voluntary sector should fund. We have just finished an extraordinary review of the state of the nation in terms of where end-of-life care community services are good, bad, and indifferent. And we will be publishing that over the months to come once we've substantiated it. But I just tell you, there are stunning inequities between different places, and some of them are quite surprising. But I think one of the reasons for that is that statutory obligations hasn't been clear. I think it's quite fair to just bash the commissioners for all this. So we're saying that assessment of the patient should be a statutory obligation and should be funded by the state. We're saying that the coordination of the patient's care should be a statutory obligation and funded by the state. And broadly speaking, we're saying that the clinical care of the patient, irrespective of setting, be it hospital, hospice, care home, or community, should be a statutory obligation and fully funded by the state, of the patient. Basic, safe, clinical care. And nothing else should be. So that everything else would have to rely on the voluntary sector for provision. And we've made various recommendations to the Secretary of State of what falls in and out of that equation. Alan, in my view, is that actually this is unlikely to cost net money to the taxpayer. We think over time the reverse will apply. As more people come into the community, less cost will be seen in hospitals. We're also recommending that there should be incentivization of earlier recognition of palliative care, picking up the gentleman's point in terms of care homes. And we recommend also that it's got to be fair to all providers. I'm terribly worried, actually, that, and Alan and I were throughout this review, that the perverse consequence of our review might be that care in hospital was demonised. You know, everybody now wants to get people into the community, everyone talking about how wonderful community and hospice care and care home care is, but what about the 57% of us who are still cared for when we die in hospitals? And finally, and then I'll close, going back to the essay question, how can the review improve end-of-life care? Well, it can only improve it if it's adopted. And you'll understand that I'm a little bit frustrated, as I often am, by the fact that we're talking about 2015, although I was very pleased at the Help the Hospices AGM that the Secretary of State hinted that he wanted to accelerate the timetable. But I do hope we can get on with this, because every year, otherwise, 600,000 people will not receive the end-of-life care that I think they should. But there's a key role for the voluntary sector in this, and I just wanted, since the voluntary sector is well represented here, I want you to think about the following questions. A week after Virgin, Richard Branson, was given the contract to provide all community care in West and North Surrey, where we had just, with the SHA's encouragement, invested an additional £250,000 of nurses. That's a little bit confusing for us. Are you happy about that? Are you sure that that's going to be quality? Is the role of the voluntary sector to simply be a pack horse who is willingly led by the commissioners into providing more care in the areas that are already doing it well and commissioning well? Because that's what's likely to happen. Or do you want to be the gadfly and actually do what I think charities were set up to do, which is to address areas of need rather than chasing contracts? And I'm going to challenge the voluntary sector. I think we've got into the trap of chasing contracts and commissioners rather than identifying and improving the quality of patient care. And with those words, I'll stop.